All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Welcome to today's Janie B. Journal Club webinar. I hope you had a wonderful holiday and glad you're with us today. My name is Rachel Dager. I'm the Associate Executive Director of SNEB. And just a little bit of housekeeping to get us started. If you look in your GoToWebinar panel, there is the handout for today available, so you can download that and take notes as you follow along. We will take questions at the end of the presentation. Please type those in the question block so we can moderate your questions to our presenter. When I close out the session today, there'll be a short survey, and we appreciate your feedback on this session, as well as any suggestions for topics for future sessions. And then watch for an email from me. I'll get that out by the end of the day on Wednesday of this week with a link to the recording that you're making. The slides link will be in there, as well as the CEU certificate that you're earning for your attendance today. So our moderator today is Virginia Quick. She's Assistant Research Professor at Rutgers University.
Thank you, Rachel. And we're excited today to have Dr. Megan Patton-Lopez. She's currently a postdoctoral research associate at Oregon State University, focusing on community-based nutrition and physical activity research among high school youth. She completed her Ascend Accredited Dietetic Internship Program at Oregon Health Science University, where she served as a HRSA maternal and child health trainee in public health nutrition. Prior to completing her doctorate in public health, she worked with low-income middle and high school students as a youth counselor with the Federal TRIO program in Louisville, Kentucky. Her research interests include understanding the sociocultural and environmental determinants of food access and safe recreation spaces among vulnerable populations. And we're excited to have her here today to share with us her research looking at the prevalence and correlates of food insecurity among students attending a mid-sized rural university in Oregon. And with that, I will let Dr. Megan Patton-Lopez begin.
Great. Thank you very much, Ginger and Rachel. I'm excited to be with you all this morning. Greetings from Oregon. Today I'll be sharing with you
Megan, this is Rachel. We might have lost you on the audio.
Earlier when our own, within the own university, Western Oregon, was concerned and wanting to explore the need for a food pantry on their campus. So I'll go over the article and what we found back then, and then, you know, if there's questions and people would like to have a discussion about things that are happening more currently, that would be great, a great addition to the presentation. So getting started, the learning objectives for today, to webinar participants will be able to understand the importance of addressing food insecurity among students of higher ed programs, and also to understand a little more about the determinants of food insecurity among college students, and to understand the need for assessing and understanding the challenges that students of higher ed programs face in order to design effective food insecurity and nutrition interventions. So as many of you probably are well aware, this is the definition of food insecurity that was developed by Cohen et al. And is featured with the USDA's Economic Research Office and the Community Food Security Assessment Toolkit. That food insecurity is the access by all people at all times to sufficient food for an active and healthy life, and it includes at a minimum the ready availability of nutritionally adequate and safe foods and the assured ability to acquire it in culturally acceptable ways. And then the opposite of that is food insecurity, and that's when households face limited or uncertain availability of nutritionally adequate and safe foods, and the limited or uncertain ability to acquire them in acceptable foods in socially acceptable ways, such as growing their own food or purchasing it from a grocery store. And the USDA kind of has two levels of food insecurity. There's low food security, in which households, they may obtain enough food to avoid disrupting their eating patterns or reducing their overall food intake by using a variety of coping strategies, such as eating a less varied diet, so eating a lot of filler foods, such as you think of ramen noodles and pasta, potatoes, and participating in federal food assistance programs, or getting emergency food from community food pantries to meet their food needs. And then they have another category that they've distinguished as very low food security, which means that normal eating patterns of one or more of the household members are disrupted, and they are reducing their food intake during times of the year due to insufficient money or other resources for food. And this is a graph, a trend showing the trends overall in the U.S. We see prevalence rates of food insecurity and very low food security in U.S. households. And so the USDA, with the current population survey, has been studying or monitoring food security since the late 1990s. And you can see the trends here that food insecurity in green kind of hovers around 12%. It went up higher in 2008, I think, due to the recession, and is slowly coming back down to 12%. And then you see the levels of very low food security, where eating patterns are greatly disrupted and there is limited intake of food, is normally around 4 to 5% of the U.S. population. And we know overall that there are certain groups that are at higher risk of experiencing food insecurity. Food insecurity is an indicator of material hardship, and so we see that low-income households are at greater risk for experiencing food insecurity. Women, especially single mothers and children, are at higher risks, higher than the national average. Families with young children and households of color. In addition to place, there's determinants based on place. We see that rural families or rural households have higher rates of food insecurity. And also we see in the South, households living in the South and on the West Coast also experience food insecurity at higher rates. And so that led us to also there's been previous research has shown that food insecurity can disrupt optimal development throughout the life cycle from the prenatal through prenatal period into the elder years. And there has been a growing body of research looking at students among school-aged and teenage high school students, and literature has documented the negative effects of food insecurity on cognition, child development, academic performance, and mental health. We see that households that are food insecure, students are high school students, have higher rates of suicide ideation and reporting of depression. We also see negative outcomes on testing and attendance with school. And many of these negative effects are associated not only with the stress and anxiety that accompany the worrying and preoccupation around having enough food, but also the consequences of reduced nutrient and caloric intake. And then about this time in 2011, there was a lot of discussion in the media around the rising costs of tuition and the financial hardship that university students were experiencing as they were trying to cover tuition, housing, and other expenses related to the university experience. And this is a more recent graph that I found from CNBC, and it just highlights the inflation related to college cost as it compares to other areas such as transportation, food and beverage, housing, and medical care. And you can see in the light green dots there, that's the public four-year for tuition and fees only, and you can see how it has been outpacing other costs. And so that's really what led us to start thinking about food insecurity among university students that we hadn't seen previously empirical research documenting the extent to which food insecurity was prevalent on university campuses. And so the focus of our study was to examine the prevalence and to identify correlates of food insecurity among students attending a rural university in Oregon. And we felt, we really took the life course approach in highlighting the need to address this critical time period for young adolescents, young or late adolescents, young adulthood. There was research documenting that college students are facing life-changing milestones during their transition to adulthood, and that this that food insecurity and the negative impacts could have long-lasting effects. And we felt that, you know, food insecurity during these years could potentially affect academic and psychosocial development, as well as success in completing higher education programs. And at the time, only two studies had previously examined food insecurity among university students. Chaparro et al. Had looked at food insecurity among students at the Hawaii at Manoa campus, and then Hughes et al. In Australia had looked at food insecurity among students on their campuses. And so our methods, we worked with this was part of a course project, our HE 471. It's a senior level community health program planning course. And the students there were interested in working with an organization who wanted to start a food pantry on campus. And so they were asked to develop a needs assessment. And we have 10-week quarters here out in Oregon. And so we really had a short amount of time to do the needs assessment and the planning and everything that needed to take place. And so we distributed via email a web-based survey to all students that were attending the university in May 2011. And it was a 40-item survey. It went out to everyone. And within that two-week period that we had this survey available, we had a total of 354 students complete the survey, which was a 7% response rate. And we built the survey based on relevant factors in previous research that had looked at food insecurity among university students, so the two earlier studies that had taken place, and then also included questions regarding to credit card debt, employment, and financial aid. We used the food insecurity six-item short form developed by the USDA, and that scale was reduced down to two categories, with zero being food secure and one being food insecure, and we found that the internal consistency was strong at 0.3. We calculated summary statistics for all the variables, and we looked at the chi-square goodness of fit to compare the fit of the sample with selected campus-wide demographic characteristics. And then we ran a two-step multivariate logistic regression model to evaluate the association between the correlates and food insecurity, adjusting for socio-demographic factors, and we used Stata 11 for our analysis. And so from the results, we found that the sample, although it was a small response rate, we found that the sample was representative of the student population at the university for full-time undergraduate Latino students, but that it overrepresented female students. Most of our students reported living off campus, and about half of them said that they had a job in addition to attending college, and the average number of hours working per week was 18. And few students reported having no credit card debt, and the majority of the participants were female and single, and between the ages of 19 and 24, and 8% reported being Hispanic or Latino. And so this is from the article, the summary statistics that some of those I already mentioned, but just to highlight, again, we had 59% of the students reported experiencing food insecurity within the past 12 months, and then also just to highlight, 76% reported receiving financial aid, and 50% were employed. And there you can see the credit card debt. About 71% had less than or equal to $500 or $499. The results of the multivariate logistic regression, income was the strongest correlate of food insecurity. Those students who reported an income less than $15,000 were about twice as likely to experience food insecurity. Students reporting fair or poor health were also more likely to be food insecure. And employed students were almost twice as likely to be food insecure compared to those who did not, who reported not working. And then again, those participating in food assistance programs and those with a low were more likely to experience food insecurity. We saw in regards to the grade point average, students with a grade point average greater than or equal to 3.1 were 60% less likely to be food insecure. And we found no significant associations between living arrangement health insurance status, physical activity, enrollment status, meaning full or part-time, or demographic factors and food insecurity. And here is the table from the article, and then the stars in red highlight the statistically significant results that were highlighted on the previous slide. And the food assistance programs that we inquired about were emergency food from a church, food pantry or food bank, emergency kitchen, the special supplemental nutrition program for women, and our nutrition program for women, infants, and children, so WIC, and then also the SNAP program. We found it was interesting to us to see that 59% of the sample reported experiencing food insecurity. That was much higher than the general population at the time, which was 15%, or other college student populations. And so Chaparro in Hawaii, the researchers there observed 45% of the students were food insecure. And I have this map here just to highlight again that we see kind of there is a, based on place, we do see higher rates of food insecurity in the more in the south and then the west coast. And Oregon historically has experienced, households have reported higher rates, of food insecurity. We're consistently among the top five states in the country to have high rates of food insecurity. So that could be related to that number that we saw at 59%. And then we also observed this this relationship between students working and averaging at 18 hours, but that range really was pretty wide, from 4 to 42 hours a week. So on top of carrying 15 credit hours, students are also working, many of them 20 hours a week, and that these students were almost twice as likely to report experiencing food insecurity. And so that sense of material hardship was kind of coming through, that students felt the need to work to meet the needs of going to college, and that that working, that could be a risk factor, the 20 hours or more a week is a risk factor for not doing well in classes and succeeding and completing the degree program in which they were enrolled, but also then if they're also struggling to acquire enough nutritious, adequate food, that there would also be negative implications for student success and academic performance. And this was similar to previous research who had looked at, academic performance in school age and high school youth. Some of the limitations, this study was cross-sectional and it relied on student self-report. It was a non-probability sample, it was a low response rate. It may have increased the likelihood of sampling error and non-response bias. However, it was representative of the university population for some of the groups and then overrepresented females. And this study also used the short form of the USDA Food Security Scale, and unlike the full 18-item scale, this short scale does not directly measure children's experience of food insecurity and does not capture the most severe adult food insecurity. So for those households and those student parents, we were not able to capture if they were at higher risk for experiencing food insecurity or the impact that this might have for the children. Some implications for research. A key finding in this study was that food insecurity is a significant issue for more than half of the college students surveyed, and that this signaled a need to, when you look at college student health, to expand on the focus on just looking at risk behaviors, to also look at social and economic factors that are influencing health, such as economic hardship and food insecurity. At the time, the literature that we found that looked at diet and college students' health and well-being was looking more at weight gain and also risky behaviors related to sexual health and drug and alcohol and mental health, but there wasn't that connection, that strong of a connection with food insecurity at the time. And we felt that future research should explore food insecurity among college student families with children and assess not only their eating behaviors, but also the campus nutrition environment and what do students have access to. And we propose that longitudinal and qualitative studies should be considered to really look at, to monitor the persistence of food insecurity throughout the college years. And then implications for practice, and this is where we're really seeing, you know, within the past two to three years since the publication, there really has been, you know, a growth in practice around supporting students in food insecurity. And so we recommended or discussed the strengthening support systems to increase access to nutritious foods for students on campus. We thought that on-campus food banks and gardens may be a valuable intervention that can help support access to nutritious foods, and that the SNAP eligibility requirements for college students could be examined and revised. Currently, college students can apply and are eligible for SNAP benefits if they have been awarded and worked at least 1 hour of campus work study, or they're working more than 20 hours or have children in the household, and that really is difficult for some students to juggle in order to meet the eligibility requirements. And there was also, we noted that there is a need for a broader food system, right-based approach to food security, and including college students and their environments, and that it's necessary to consider additional initiative and policies to increase access to nutritious foods and improve students' economic stability. And so really looking at, are students able to address their basic needs, including food, so that they can focus on their education. And so some of the things that have happened that many of you may be aware of, there is the College and University Food Bank Alliance that has been working with community colleges and four-year institutions around the country to promote access to food pantries. There's campus community gardens. There's been a growth in looking at cooking classes and you know, programs for university students. And so there's really been this a lot of support in areas, especially looking in like California, and the University of California system has done a lot with food security and addressing this issue. And so one of the thoughts from this, or just an observation, is that, you know, really looking at this holistically, so looking at how the community surrounding the university and the university itself can work together to improve access to food, and also housing that is affordable, because many times housing insecurity and food insecurity go hand in hand. And then also finally, just to acknowledge the students that participated in the public health program planning course at Western. It was really their passion that really got this project moving, and I think it just speaks well to them that this was an identified student issue from the beginning, and that hopefully, you know, we continue to work and listen and incorporate the voices of students when we're looking at policy and interventions to support access to healthy food. So with that, my references, for the complete list of references, you can find them in the article. And so I'll take if there are any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Megan Pan Lopez, for a lovely presentation and sharing with us your findings from your needs assessment on your campus looking at food insecurity. I was kind of surprised to see such a high prevalence of food insecurity on your campus. And I know, you know, since your needs assessment, I had talked to you prior to your presentation, and you had said you have a food pantry or food bank on campus. Would you be able to kind of explain how that kind of took off and where it is right now on your campus?
Okay. Well, back in 2011, there was a group on the student government was considering or was interested in starting a food pantry, working with the Marion Polk Food Share that is in within the Kent community. And so they were, you know, we first completed this needs assessment to get a sense of the documenting the need. And in addition to the questions that we promote that are analyzed in our study, they also asked questions around, you know, the type of, you know, the some of the more like logistical, like the, how often or what time of day should the pantry be open, the location, and things like that. And so since 2011, the food pantry has been open and is on campus, and it is free to anyone. And so the data that is collected shows that there are people from outside of the community that also come in and access the food pantry. It's open 5 days, I believe it's open 5 days a week. It's really volunteer-based and run on volunteer time. They do have two student coordinators that are kind of working about 10 hours a week. But they've really seen, I mean, some of the students that I'm working with this quarter are kind of taking a look at the food pantry again and kind of thinking about, well, is this really meeting our needs, or are there things that might need to change about how we're implementing the food pantry on the campus? And they do offer the one thing, it is a shopping-based experience that students can come in. They don't have to give their real name because of the stigma associated, and so they come in and they just shop and they can pick up food. There have been some difficulties when keeping the food pantry open because it is purely volunteer run, getting that system in place has been a bit of a challenge. So there are definitely some ways to improve, and I think there's lots of good models out there. There's lots of there's universities in California and across the country who have been starting and implementing food pantries, and with the Food Pantry Alliance, the Food Bank Alliance, the College and University Food Bank Alliance, really looking at best practices and kind of learning from one another on what seems to, to be successful in meeting the needs of students.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. And so the Food Pantry, do you know how many people they're serving? I don't know if you know that off the top of your head, but I was just curious to see if they have regular, amounts of people that are coming more frequently, or just any thoughts you might have.
Yes, we that's the other thing, because it's volunteer-based, is the number of visits, so not necessarily the people and the frequency and how often they come, but just the number of visits. And I believe over the past, since May of 2016, that they've had about 1,500 visits. And so it is, when it is available, when it is open, I mean, technically it's supposed to be open all, 5 days a week, from morning until later in the evening. But because of trying to coordinate the volunteer schedules, I don't know how in practice if it is available as much as they would mm-hmm. like it to be. But they had recorded that it is, it is quite a few students are accessing it, but the students here that I'm working with this quarter really believe that there needs to be more marketing, thinking of a social marketing campaign and looking at the product, the pantry, is it really designed to meet the needs, and kind of looking at it now that it's been implemented for the past 5 years, kind of are we really meeting the need and is there a way to improve upon it? So.
I wonder also if there's any stigma surrounded around going to a food pantry and picking up food as a student.
Yeah, and that's what, at least the students have reported and what some of the studies that have come out since this article, that, stigma. And also in California, I believe it's at Humboldt State, they were working to try to have a social marketing campaign to reduce the stigma of applying for SNAP benefits. So they really, looks like they were really doing a lot of work to kind of help students have that not be a burden or a barrier to accessing support in order to, to do well in school and to think of it as just another resource to help them succeed academically.
Yeah. So another question I have for you from one of the listeners, they wanted to know what was the response of the Western Oregon University administration when you presented the results from your needs assessment.
The Western Oregon University, it really has had a history of supporting, wanting to support first-generation low-income students. That's part of the mission of the university here. So it was really, I think they were surprised. Definitely, food insecurity across the country can be pretty invisible, and it's not something that is spoken, a lot outside of maybe, community nutrition or public health. So for the administration, this was something that they you know, that they were concerned about, and but they really were supportive. I mean, they've put the funding, you know, they've given the student government funding to help support the, you know, the food pantry. They have done work on food gardens, and they're working with the campus dining to look at sustainability and dining. So they have been very supportive. I mean, and I think that goes, again, to the mission of the university, to really want to see the students that come here, the low-income students that come here, to succeed and be successful in completing their degree and then, you know, moving on and, you know, being engaged and responsible citizens, you know, so that's really part of their mission. So it's been really supportive. And I think a lot of the other universities, at least that I've read, you know, with the different initiatives across the country, that, you know, many universities are recognizing that this is important for outcomes, you know, for their students to enroll and then complete their degree in 5 years. So I think it's a win-win for the universities and also for the students.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Now, for the food that you receive for the food pantry, I guess two-part question. Where does it come from? I'm guessing it's private donations. And then is there any thought on the nutritional and, you know, quality of the foods received and given to those in need?
Mm-hmm. Well, the food is part of the in Oregon, in the Oregon Food Bank, the state agency that helps implement the food pantries across Oregon, and so they've really done a lot to look at nutrition and what are families receiving that are receiving emergency food. And so Marion Polk Food Share is a member of the, you know, the Oregon Food Bank, and that's where Marion and Polk are the two counties that it's located in. And so Marion Polk Food Share is where the majority of the food is coming from for the students. And so it's part of a larger network in Oregon, and they do, the students do food drives on both faculty and, you know, and collecting food, but there has been some education to faculty, you know, when you're donating cans of food, these are the types of foods that we need. But also, too, I think there's also, it's looking at what also can be, you know, the shelf life of the food and what students can also prepare, you know, looking at their ability to, their self-efficacy around cooking. So, but I haven't been as closely involved with the food pantry. Definitely something that my students have been, you know, engaged in and wanting to support. You know, I think having the food pantry on campus is a great start, and that it's, you know, really helps meet the immediate need of food, and it's also a way for students to talk about food insecurity and to, you know, to be visible. It's a visible space on campus that I think is kind of reminds faculty and staff and the administration that food insecurity is an issue. But, you know, food pantries never were designed to solve food insecurity. So in addition to having food pantries and food gardens, you know, I think these are all great steps to meet the immediate need. I think that there is lots of room for community and campus partnerships on looking at the fundamental causes of food insecurity among students. So looking at housing costs, looking at access to food in the community, or looking at the cost of education or the amount of financial aid that low-income students are receiving. When we see that, you know, the majority, you know, many of our students, more than half of our students are working between 4 and 42 hours a week on top of full-time classes, I mean, that really signals that students are struggling with finances. And so I think that also needs to be part of the conversation and looking at, okay, so how do we support students? How do we help them access all of the supports that are currently available, such as SNAP and WIC, you know, the use of food pantries when needed, but also kind of looking at the, you know, the price tag of the university and the fact that tuition has gone up almost every year, and it's, you know, outpaced, you know, the inflation, the cost of tuition has outpaced the cost of almost everything else, and we're at a time when states are receiving less federal funding to support their public universities. So I think there's, you know, there's definitely, there's lots of room to work at a variety of levels to really support low-income students and first-generation students so that they can be successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that kind of answers one of the questions that a listener had. They were curious as how institutions of higher education are working to reverse the growing trend of food insecurity on campus. And it seems, you know, it's just tackling the high tuition cost is one way that would be nice for them to tackle, because there are a lot of financial constraints that a lot of these students face.
And it's interesting. I mean, many places around the country are doing this, but in Oregon, they now have a program, the Oregon Promise, that for 2 year, you know, for the 2 year community college, you know, it's basically tuition. Tuition is covered for Oregon students, so high school students can go to a community college for 2 years. You know, it would be interesting to see how does that impact, you know, does it make a difference for low-income students? You know, are there still other costs in addition to tuition that are economic hardship for these students? You know, is it also housing? I mean, many of these students, you know, are coming from homes that may have experienced food insecurity in the past, so it may not be a new experience for them, but, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot, you know, even working in the high school level and looking at food insecurity and the success that low-income students have on completing their degrees and then going on to higher education.
Yeah, and with that being said, you know, after they graduate, most students have student loans. Mm-hmm. Are you aware of any work that's being done to address food insecurity for those graduating students as they start their careers and have to start paying their student loans and rents?
Yeah, no, I haven't seen, I mean, it may be out there, but I haven't seen a study, and that's where I think it would be interesting to look at that experience upon graduation and what happens, you know, after graduation. You know, there is the educational longitudinal study that at least has been done in the past that looks at, you know, especially looking at the success and what happens when low-income students go on to higher ed. But I haven't been working in this area or know that if it's continuing to follow students, you know, mm-hmm. now and looking at their experiences afterwards. But I definitely think, you know, that there is room to track this, you know, to measure this, because, you know, having food insecurity questions, the 6-item or the 18-item questions that's developed at the USDA, you know, having that on this research that's being done in higher education, or also for like the American College Health Association. You know, many universities implement their survey to help their student health services understand the need of campus. But food insecurity is not a core module. It's something that universities, mm-hmm. at least last spring when I was looking at this, it was something that the universities would have to pay extra if they wanted to add those questions. And so, you know, that increases the cost of the survey, whereas if it was something that came standard, you know, we would start to have, you know, I think it's been well documented now there that food insecurity is an issue across, you know, it's a common concern across campuses, 2-year and 4-year institutions. And so now it's looking at, okay, so how do we mobilize and collaborate? What type of partnerships do we implement, and what are the best practices in supporting these students, you know, maybe before they get to college, through their college experience, and then, you know, afterwards? And what role does student loan debt have on food security status? That's something that I haven't seen. But definitely if others know of those types of studies, I'd be interested in seeing them and sharing if they wouldn't mind sharing.
Okay, great. Yeah, thank you. So another question, we have a listener had was asking whether or not there were any comparisons between the cost of room and board at the university and the prevalence of food insecurity on campus. I don't know if you were able to look at the correlation of that in your study that they were interested in hearing.
No, and at the time when this study took place, I believe the university either you had, it was like a general dining plan, that if you live on campus, you know, everyone had the same dining plan, and so there wasn't a way to look at those who chose the more expensive plan versus those who chose the most economical plan. And many of the students lived off campus, too, for us, and we didn't see this living on campus or having a campus meal plan, having that be a significant, you know, having a significant relationship, statistically significant relationship with food insecurity. I know that other work that I'm involved in at Oregon State University, they're planning to implement a survey in the spring, and that is one thing that the housing and dining director and the dietitian that works with housing and dining is really curious, because they've seen anecdotally that many students are trying to lower the cost of attendance by choosing the most, you know, economical meal plan, but that doesn't, it wasn't designed to meet all the meals mm-hmm. needed for a full semester, and so she's really interested in looking at, is there a difference between, you know, between the different yeah. plans, but we didn't calculate that, and we didn't ask either about rent, the cost of rent in this study that right. we did in May of 2011, which definitely I think could yeah. also could be definitely playing a role in how much money is left over to buy food.
Yeah. What I'm curious is, do you have a large commuter population, or is it, are most of them stay on campus?
Well, we only had on campus, most, I think only 20%, 29% lived on campus. It's a, and then, you know, we're, most of the students live in the surrounding community, and they do, you know, commute in, but not too far. I mean, there are some students that maybe commute at most a half an hour, but I think the majority of the students here live pretty close to campus. But it is a rural, we are in a rural community. And so, you know, it's a small campus community. So
I was just curious if a number of them just live with their parents and commute. And so the rent wouldn't be an issue.
Right. Yeah, for some of these, for some of these students, I'm trying to think on the we had about 29% lived off campus, 34 or 35% lived off campus with roommates, and then another 36% lived off campus with other, so either with their family or single. So it was a mix.
Were you able also to collect information on their self-reported height and weight so you could look at BMI and how that relates to food insecurity?
Yeah, we did not. We only, the only health questions that we looked at was that that self-report of fair poor health, which has been, in previous research, has been a strong indicator of overall health. And so that's the only, and then the moderate physical activity, we looked at that. But those were the only two health-related, in addition to food insecurity questions that we included on the survey. Yeah, we had 40 items, and so we were really trying to keep it, you know, to improve the response rate, keep it as compact as we could, and look at some of those factors that might be influencing food insecurity. And then we had the additional questions. Like I said before, we had about 5 or 6 questions related to if there was a pantry on campus, would you use it? And, you know, kind of the time of day, those sorts of questions that the food pantry, the Student Government Association could then use to plan their food pantry.
Okay, great. Now, just to clarify, I know that you used 6 items from one of the USDA's modules on food insecurity. Did you adapt those questions? I know you had 6 items, or did you use exactly those questions, how they're written and phrased? Because one of the listeners wants to know if they could see those questions and where they could find them. Maybe you can help in directing them.
Yes, definitely. We did, and those questions have been used pretty consistently with other populations. And I'm happy to share that survey, share those questions. It is pretty much the way that the USDA has. If you were to just do a Google search and put USDA food security module 6 item, it would probably pop up. But there has been work with adapting the tool, and has been tested and validated to work with high school or youth, adolescents. And so the wording on the question, is a little less maybe formal or academic and maybe more approachable for a younger, an adolescent population. And that work, I'm happy to share with anyone, those questions, and it's escaping me at the moment on the researchers who have done that, but there has been a tool developed based on the 6 item, but it's just looking at the wording and how, the phrasing of the questions, but has been validated to work with high school students, so our youth, adolescent youth, which may also be a good tool to use for 18 to 24-year-old audiences.
Okay. Great, and I'm sure if anybody, would like to see them, they can reach out to you. They have your email, which is great.
Yeah, and there has been quite a bit done. Like I mentioned, there's the Wisconsin Hope Lab that is doing a lot of great work. They have a lot of public reports, data briefs and policy statements, and they have a lot of tools as well. They've used the 6 item short form from the USDA and have kind of put it into a survey format. So that is available online as well, and they have a report out in December called Hungry to Learn, addressing food and housing insecurity among undergraduates, and then also the Global Food Initiative by the University of California has a lot of great resources. And then finally, it seems it just came out in October, there's Hunger on Campus, the Challenge of Food Insecurity for College Students. And that was just looks like it was a study much larger where they surveyed 2-year and 4-year institutions across 12 states. They had over 3,800 students. And they found that 48% of their respondents reported food insecurity in the past 30 days. So, there's definitely a lot of great resources out there that I think folks can pull from. But I think as nutrition and community health practitioners, I think it's there's a place for our profession to work with higher administration, campus university administration, and folks who are looking at higher ed to design interventions that that meet the nutrition and food needs of students on campuses.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So I have another question that's kind of off topic, but could be related. They've read that the rate of homelessness in parts of Oregon is high, and they were wondering how this might affect food insecurity rates in that state.
Right. No, definitely. Food insecurity and housing insecurity, are related. I think that just on that that study that I just mentioned, that Hunger on Campus, they found that among those students that were food insecure, 64% of those students also reported experiencing some type of housing insecurity. And so in Fort Oregon as well, there's been quite a bit of research, over the past decade on why does Oregon have such high rates of food insecurity. And I think, it could be a lot of things. Definitely the cost of housing is high, I think being on the West Coast, and then also looking at are people earning a living wage and, the revenue or the income that they're able to earn to meet the basic needs. I think that there's it's around $27 an hour is considered a living wage for Oregon, but yet, minimum wage is $15 an hour here, so it's better than the national minimum wage. But I don't know, I haven't seen a study in Oregon that's really looked at that closely at food insecurity and housing. Definitely, I think it's something that would be a great issue to look at. And And again, you know, if there is a study out there that someone is aware of, it could be great if they could share it. But I haven't seen it lately. And a lot of times, you know, it's been looking at like these economic shocks and having support systems and looking at what's driving food insecurity in Oregon. But I think definitely there is a momentum in Oregon to look at housing insecurity. A lot of the counties are looking at safe and adequate housing. So I think there's a real opportunity to partner. And at least in Benton County, you know, previously I was the epidemiologist for Benton County and really worked with community organizations and to look at food insecurity. And it's one of the five areas that our community health improvement plan is addressing, in addition to housing. And so many of the work groups do, the two work groups do overlap with the members and also do, you know, communicate on, let's look at these issues simultaneously, because definitely it's not an isolated factor. I mean, they're both signs of, you know, I think they're both really closely related. And then underlying need is that material hardship and what households have, what resources they have to meet their needs. So it's definitely a complex issue, you know, so it takes a lot of different, I think a lot of different perspectives and people with different training and backgrounds to kind of work together to start locally. At least I really believe in working locally in communities to start, you know, looking at how our services are being offered, how are they, you know, do we have wraparound services, are students being included? I think a lot of times, you know, I think this has been a big surprise, is food insecurity on campuses, because, you know, low income, being in poverty or being low income during college years was kind of considered a rite of passage, right? That, you know, many students, this was something that was a temporary time where you just ate ramen noodles and studied all the time. But I don't think that's really the reality for many of these students, especially low income students, that it's not a rite of passage and that it could have, you know, negative health outcomes, you know, kind of looking at, again, to that life course model, you know, what type of trajectory are they on if they're not able to really succeed and do their best in college at a time when they're gaining skills that are going to influence the types of jobs they get in the future, or even if they if they can finish. You know, many of them will take on large amount of debts and then not even finish their degree, but yet still have to pay back their student loans. And so it really is, I think, a critical time that, you know, these students really do need as many supports that are available in the community or on campus as we can provide, and then also take a critical look at how higher education is financed in our country.
Yeah, all very good points. And, you know, thank you, Dr. Megan Payton Lopez, for really, you know, looking at this very important topic. We know that, based on your research, that food insecurity not only affects, you know, the nation, but also in particular college students at the university level. So I really, you know, thank you for your work in this area, and then even starting a food pantry on campus, very impressive. And I'm sure other people listening in and other community health educators can really learn from your work in this area. So thank you again for your time and being able to present today. I don't know if there's any last-minute words you would like to share, but thank you again, and thank you. Yeah,
thank you. No, I appreciate the invitation. It's great to share our work, and, you know, I really look forward to connecting with others who are maybe working in this area or have thoughts and ideas. Definitely, it's something that we're trying to continue to work on and find ways to meet the needs of our students. So thanks again, and I look forward to having the future emails.
Okay, great. Yeah, and if anybody needs or wants to reach out to our presenter today, her email is right here on the slide, and I will let Rachel close out today's webinar.
Excellent. Thank you. Just a reminder, next Monday, December 5th, is our last in this fall series of Journal Club webinars. So we'll have Marla Reichs, Julie Reeder, and Megan Coker looking at the impact of cooking and home food preparation interventions among adults. So if you have not registered for that, please jump on the SNEB website to do that. And also a reminder also that week, on Wednesday, we're doing a webinar on probiotics. And then next Friday is the session on a skills building session on selecting appropriate images for your communications. So three webinars next week, busy week. So if you're interested in any of those, and you know, and as always, if you're not able to attend live and you'd like to register so that you get the follow-up email, you are more than welcome to do that. And then we are finalizing our schedule for the spring. So we're going to look at policies, systems, and environmental change initiatives and programs to improve health. Our first spring Journal Club session will be on February 6th, and right now we have 11 sessions planned for the spring. When I do the follow-up email for this session, when you get that on Wednesday, I'll try to get a link in there if you want to go ahead and get registered for all the sessions in the spring. And when I close things out, you'll see a little follow-up survey for today's session, and we appreciate your responses. Thank you.